And she's got a good sense of humor. She said, I thought I was going to be picked up.
Okay, well, let's start off with your full name, just for the record.
You've got the tape on.
Yep, got the tape on now.
It's an interesting looking record.
It picks up very well. It's kind of reverberating.
My name is Kenneth Walter Joseph Butler.
And your date and place of birth?
Halifax, about 7:30 in the evening, February the 1st, 1929. Jubilee Road, 133, opposite St. Thomas Aquinas School.
Okay. So what years did you attend St. Mary's?
St. Mary's from about 1947 to 1950.
So did you attend...
Excuse me, I've got to think about that a bit. If I graduate in 50, take off 4, so that...
46.
But another 3 for high school. Mm-hmm. So it must have been around about 1943. So it was during the war. And you started in grade 9, 10, 11. There was no grade 12 in those days. Then you went in freshman, first year, and science was a four-year course. But if you took science in engineering subjects, then you graduated with your engineering certificate after the third year, and you got to go to the graduation twice, in your third year and then your fourth year. After your third year, you could go to Nova Scotia Tech for various types of engineering, civil, mechanical, electrical, etc. So if you stayed and got your degree, that was 4 years. So you got a science degree in engineering subjects.
I see. Is that what you did?
Yes.
Okay. So at the time, it was the Jesuits?
The Jesuits had taken over a few years before. It had been the Christian Brothers prior.
Mm-hmm. And what were they like as educators?
As educators? I think it was fun for a boy who had been educated by women at St. Thomas Aquinas and the Catholic schools in Halifax, because it was a divided school system. It was public, but there was Catholic, and there was so-called non-Catholic or Protestant, whichever way you want to put it. So when we arrived at St. Mary's, now you had men that were teaching you, and some of them were pretty hard compared to what we were experiencing with nice ladies and nuns. Nevertheless, it was new and interesting.
Mm-hmm. What was their approach to teaching?
Tougher than the women, of course, and there was always an emphasis on Latin, which was a pain for somebody who was interested in sciences. And yet, we took it, and it was good for us. French. We didn't get a lot out of these things because they weren't practical languages for us. Mm-hmm. A lot of history out of Latin, believe it or not. And then we had mathematics, algebra, and geometry, and trigonometry. And then as we got into university, then we had differential and integral calculus, which was all part of the engineering.
Mm-hmm. So how would you describe the workload?
The workload? Mm-hmm. It was probably much to do if you were a serious student. And that is very interesting. That's a very interesting question when we talk about serious students. We were young fellows. At the point of puberty, just after puberty, and the testosterone was flowing, and girls were very important in your thoughts. You never get very much chance to go out with girls, but it was a major distraction for you. I think today, if you had girls in the classroom under those circumstances, the boys would be totally distracted. There was something that I wanted to explain to you on that. So the girls never came to the university once a year. Perhaps there would be some girls come. I don't think they ever had a freshman dance or anything at the university. That would be too much of a disruption because of it being a boys' school only. The building was quite small.
Yes.
One of the things I remember in particular was there was a terrible old rough door. It must have been about 3.5 feet wide and about 8 feet tall, heavy as anything, and it was balanced by a huge metal weight. And that was the entrance door into the side of the school, and that's where all the students went in. So when that thing opened, you better get in quick, because if it came at you and hit you, I never heard anyone getting hit, but it was a cruel type door. And if you were late, there was a dean of discipline, Father Hank McCarthy, who was a great old pussycat, but he'd make a lot of noise, and he might hit somebody on the hand if they were 20 minutes late for no particular reason. But it was just fun. So discipline was not harsh. It was, you knew who the sort of the professors were who could be awkward. And they were usually people that were perhaps not so much, I wouldn't like to say incompetent, but they certainly didn't feel competent about themselves. Not so much the Jesuits, but there was a few lay people there that really didn't have any confidence in themselves as to the subjects they were teaching. I won't mention their names. They were my personal opinions, you know. My favorites in the university was Father Buck O'Donnell, and he and I were always kibitzing back and forth because he didn't teach us, the engineers. But he decided to coach me, and I won the radio speaking contest in 1949, the first and perhaps the only engineer that ever won that. And I was runner-up for the platform speaking and the radio speaking contest the following year, and Father O'Donnell, who ran the program, said, "Damn it, you won both of them." So that was interesting.
What other activities went on at the
school? Well, there was one time I remember that they had all the students come out on the campus. The campus is where St. Patrick's High School is now on Quimple Road at Windsor. We thought it was quite a big field. And it had rocks like any field would have, and the grass wasn't great because that was where the boys played football and baseball. And there was a little sort of gravel, rash running track around it that the priests would walk around. They had to say their breviary once a day, so you'd see them walking around in their black outfits around and around. It was a terrible imposition for a priest. You know, he probably had spent an hour or two reading this a day. So anyway, we were all put out there. Maybe there was 300 students, and you had to pick rocks so the football players weren't going to fall down and get hurt. And they had a little difficult time imposing this upon us. I think we would have picked rocks more happily if it had been volunteer, but it seemed to be imposed upon us. But I remember that activity. I personally used to plow the sidewalk in the last year I was going to university with a little garden tractor. The university, of course, as you and I talked about once before, had a double handball court that was made of wood, no doubt constructed by the Christian Brothers some years before. And the side wall of that was the orphanage. And if you're balling over, probably you didn't get it back. The orphans would get it. The old building was brick. It had a little cross, if I recall, up on one of the chimneys. It always said that there was something hidden behind that brick cross. Nobody ever did say if anyone checked it when they tore the building down. There was a library, probably inadequate, but it really didn't matter to us because we seldom researched things. We were not terribly serious students. And the few things we had to research, it was adequate for us.
Any clubs or associations?
There were certain clubs with the Latin names, but the engineers didn't get so involved with that. A few of the art students did. There was quite a bit of debating. There was the MIDL debates. I was involved with those, and we were successful, another chap and I, against one of the New Brunswick teams. There was the journal, which produced about, I think, biweekly, a small sheet, which no doubt you've seen. The journal was fun. There was always somebody who was called a jotter, and he was a bit like Frank Magazine. He would get something on someone and publish it. Nobody would know who did it, but it was more in fun than anything else. Good training for anyone. There was exams, of course, which weren't much fun. You had those. You had tests quite often, but you had exams at least twice a year. And those were all held in the assembly hall, which also substituted for a priest by the name of Father Fignon, who was a no doubt a Quebec Jesuit, who was very dedicated to the Jesuit martyrs, the priests that came over in the 1700s and, of course, were martyred by the Iroquois. So he had a little, I think it was a dresser, and inside that was an altar, and he had this dedicated as a shrine to, I think it was Daniel or Brebeuf, which was kind of neat. There was a stage, and interestingly enough, in later years, in 1953, when the old university building was not being used for the university, but that hall was being used by the Newman Club, which was the Catholic association for the non-Catholic universities. So guys from a university that wasn't Catholic could go meet Catholic girls at this club. So the Mount St. Vincent girls would come in, the Convent Sacred Heart would come in, and some from Dow, some from St. Mary's and so on. There was still no girls at St. Mary's in those days. And that one particular night I went in and I met my wife, Catherine, who was going to King's taking social work. Mm-hmm. So a year later we got married, and we're still married. We've had five kids. And but coming back to activities, there was the sodality. And that was important. It was the sodality was a dedication to the Blessed Virgin Mary. So on December the 8th, every year, there was always a holiday. Or any other times during the year, there was a Catholic thing, there would be a holiday. But particularly December the 8th, we could come back, and there was a movie, and there was a big treat of ham, hot dogs, pop, and so on, all you could eat, probably two each. Mm-hmm. And there would be various minor activities, but for those days it wasn't bad, eh? And I remember they showed King Kong one night, and Father O'Donnell was running the projector, because St. Mary's was fairly high tech for those days, so they had a 16mm projector, and you could rent films, and King Kong took the top blouse off of the woman. By the way, that woman's still living. She's from a small town in the USA. And poor Father O'Donnell saw this sort of striptease happen. Whether she took it all off or not, I don't know. But anyway, he tried to stop the projector, but he missed. And this was the big thrill, you know? So, one time there was some girls came from one of the high schools or universities, for something. And they all sat in the hall, and we sat on the other side. And a university that doesn't have girls, or a high school that doesn't have girls, with guys have so much pent-up enthusiasm for girls, that it took at least 3 days for the building to settle down. Everyone was excited. The testosterone was flowing. Mm-hmm. We didn't even have that word in those days. So, activities, hockey, of course. Everyone went to the university and high school hockey and football games. In the fall of the year, there was one chap, I may have told you this the other day, his name was Joe Levinson, he was a Jewish guy, and he was going to Queen Elizabeth. And Joe was kind of a fat sort of guy, and he brought on all kinds of remarks from the St. Mary's students when he was going to Queen Elizabeth. He was playing center or snap. The following year, he came over to take freshman at St. Mary's, and my God, it was Joe, what a great guy, and he was playing center for us. And if you wanted to get any time off, the Jesuits were particularly sympathetic to Jewish people. If it was a Jewish student, he'd get away with murder. If you wanted a half day off, just ask Joe Levinson to talk to the dean and say that we had something we'd like to do, and you get the day off. But let a Catholic try, and he did. So there was prejudice, but prejudice
in favor
of the opposite. So Joe later became a war correspondent, and he was going up a hill in Korea, and he couldn't quite make the hill, so he backed up, and when he backed up, he drove over a landmine, he was killed. During university days, there was a few students died of leukemia. There was a chap who was about 5 years older than me, DeLeal Ingalls. He died, very bright guy. There was also a Miller boy whose father ran Miller Piano. Dr. Miller, who recently was the Deputy Minister of Health, his brother, he died of leukemia. You'll see that, you'll see these people in these books. There wasn't a lot of deaths. There was a priest, I think his name was Father Mullally. He died when he was president. So there was a day off, and we all went down to St. Mary's Basilica for the funeral. The bishop would come on occasions. Bishop McNally. He was fairly pompous. And at that time, they were starting to build the new St. Mary's College. The building was built of stone. The stone came from the old gas works, which originally had been the Dominion Penitentiary near Point Pleasant Park. Interestingly, my great-grandfather, John Flynn, had been the governor of the prison at the time it was closed, around 1880. They transferred all the prisoners, probably 300 or 400 of them, to Dorchester. That's when Dorchester opened. Mm-hmm. But it was kind of interesting about 1877 on St. Patrick's Night, no doubt everyone was having a drink. The prisoners broke out of their compound and broke into my grandfather's living accommodations, and he was injured, and later he was crippled. He died around 1907 in North End, Halifax. So, coming back to St. Mary's, we were very proud of being Santa Marians. We were, I suppose, looked down upon by Dalhousie simply by the scale that we were a smaller university, and of course we did not offer postgraduate courses, so we were simply offering bachelor courses, and we were partly a high school. When I graduated in 1950, I was vice president of the graduating class. I think a veteran was of name Ingalls. I think it was Ingalls. He was the president. And, of course, it wouldn't be very important to him. I haven't seen him since, but I did bring a get-together for our 25th in 1975. And I phoned around to get the people together, and it was a total graduating class in 1950 of approximately 25 students in all the faculties. And the faculties were engineering, engineering science, arts, commerce, and journalism. There was an old man. He was very quiet. His name was Adam Kievich. He taught something to the art students. Whatever it was would have to be desperately boring. We were very fortunate that we didn't have to have lectures from him because he didn't speak very good English. But he came from the area of Bosnia and that, and he had a square face, and I don't think he ever smiled. He looked sad. He obviously was separated from his family. And he sort of stayed at the university like a crippled sparrow. And I told you the story about in around 1949 or 50, when an exam was being held, the final exam was being held in the assembly hall, and Adam Kievich was sitting up on the stage, a chair and table, and he wound up his Big Ben alarm clock, and he said, "The exam, she will start." And a chaplain named Chuck Jones went up sometime later and changed the setting of the alarm clock. And of course, we were all waiting for that to go off while the exam was going on. So eventually it went off. Of course, everyone was terribly amused. And poor Adam Kievich was reaching down around the side of his chair to try and shut off the alarm clock, thinking he was in bed upstairs. And finally discovered that he was in front of everyone. So he knocked off the bell on the alarm clock, and he said, "The exam, she's over." And of course, then they pointed out to him that the time was only about a half hour had passed, and he apologized, and I don't know whether he reset the clock, but we sure as heck never forgot that little incident. There was also another fellow at that exam, and he was taking, I think, arts at the time, and the only way he could possibly pass his exams was he had set up one of those high cast iron radiators, a filing cabinet, and somehow or another he had some kind of an arrangement in there that he could select whatever information he needed to pass the exams. And that particular day, I think that the Jesuits had finally caught on to it, and he was moved from that seat, and I don't believe he passed his exams. Probably if he spent as much time studying as he did with his filing system, he probably would have passed with flying colors.
You'd mentioned an incident about a bromine spill.
Yes. I believe it was Joe Levinson. Joe was taking freshman engineering, and perhaps it was in the second year. And bromine is, I think it is extracted from seawater. It probably is something like iodine. And these are chemicals that no doubt were almost used in the household years ago, like iodine was, and creolene water and all those sorts of things. You don't hear of them today. But anyway, bromine had a very strong smell, and mucus would immediately come out of your nose and mouth. You just dripped. So anyway, Joe dropped this bottle of bromine in the lab, the chem lab upstairs. And the professor at the time, an awfully nice guy, I don't know if he's still living or not. I had his name the other day. It's the same.
Al Sabine,
same name as the boys that were brought up by the wolf that founded Rome. So Al, of course, was a great guy, and he wanted everyone out, and he was trying to clear this mess up. And we left, and we were getting everyone out of the building because the odor was desperate. And I was downstairs, and I said I hadn't seen Professor Sabine, so I went back up. And I had to pull him out of the room. I don't know whether he had collapsed or he was near collapsing. So I remember that in particular because it was a corrosion stain on the metal ceiling. In those days, the old ceilings were metal. You may have seen these fancy ceilings. They would be fastened up with nails and painted, and they look great until somebody would spill some water upstairs and they'd rust. They weren't galvanized. So there was always that stain, so you'd look and say, well, that was where the bromine was spilled.
Mm. Okay. Could you discuss what the role of religion was in your days of thinking?
Yes. The role of religion was extremely important because when you went to St. Mary's in the high school, as I mentioned to you earlier, you were awfully glad to go to St. Mary's because you didn't have to write the final exams, the provincials that you had in St. Pat's and Queen Elizabeth. Now, religion was important because the boarders had to go to Mass every morning, or were supposed to go to Mass every morning. I think Mass was either 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. And as a student, on your own, living at home, which I was a day hop, living at home, you went to Mass, of course, every Sunday. You went to confession once a week, at least. And you always had the same sins, eh? It's usually something to do about thinking about girls. And, or cursing. Very minor ones. But, when Lent would come, you know, I know I used to go to Mass and Communion every morning, and Advent before Christmas, you would go to Mass and Communion every morning. And you were always encouraged to do those things, and there was always a religion class for about half an hour, and it was called, there was other fancier names, it was ethics and different things that, that these...
Excuse me a second.
I thought my wife would get that. She
seems to be quite a pattern. Okay, so can you say that again?
Okay, now we were talking about religion, weren't we? Now, religion was very important because, you know, you wouldn't go to Dalhousie if you wanted to first get your basic degrees in the Catholic University, because you wouldn't be... it would be sort of turning your back on your religion. Well, then, following that, your children then went to St. Mary's. It wasn't necessarily in those days then, because this was now in the 60s and 70s and 80s. It wasn't because of religion, but it was simply the fact that they were following their parent, perhaps. But the university now had expanded, had bigger buildings, nicer facilities. At that point, the Jesuits were all gone, but for a token priest that might be there. And education was being handled by the province and the federal government. So, I was on the board at St. Mary's when my son was also involved with the university, Mike, who's with the Federal Justice Department here. And it was nice to know. It's a nice thing to have these roots, but the roots are so different at St. Mary's. It's a different campus than we were there. There are not the Jesuits. In other words, the family ties are gone. But you can walk in the door and you're a graduate, and having been back to St. Mary's a bit as a board member for a number of years, I did get feelings with you. With the university, and of course your children had gone there, so they were letting you know what the university was like. So perhaps I should tell you that about 1949, when I was taking engineering, Professor Ryan, who was the dean, who later became the dean of engineering, at that time the dean of engineering was Father Bercafany, the well-known astronomer that the astrological part of the university is named after. He is an extremely interesting man, a lot of fun, had a very sharp and a very sharp temper, of course, but he was known to be a genius, and by being a genius, you didn't seem to learn as much from him, because the questions you'd ask him you'd feel would be kind of mundane for such a bright person. Mm-hmm. But coming back to Mr. Ryan, who is far from being a genius, he was our dean of engineering at a later date. He wasn't at that time. He took myself and another chap, and we went down and we surveyed off the present campus of St. Mary's, the new campus. And the idea was that we were to survey it, stake it. It had been the old been part of the old Gorsbrook golf course, I believe. And we were to split it in two, one half for St. Mary's and one half for Mount St. Vincent. It was pretty obvious to us students that the campus was too small for that. And not too long afterward, when the building was started around 1949-50, it was now just going to be St. Mary's University. And that summer of 1950, I worked as an architectural draftsman for the contractor who was, I know the engineer I worked under was Pat Fleming, and the company was known as McDonald Construction. And there was tremendous cost overruns. I remember there was a priest who used to come in and get me to sit on chairs, and he'd measure you so they could decide how high they had to put the bunks. So it was pretty rinky-dink, some of those Jesuits were deciding how they were going to put the furniture in the building, because all you have to do is go to an architectural manual and all those measurements are there. So that was when the university was finished, the Catholics of the province of Nova Scotia had this tremendous debt. And I think it was considered to be around $5 million, which was a lot of money for those days. So if you take inflation into account, that would probably be, say, $25 million, say, by today's standards, which would be substantial. So the back of the building was not completed, as you know, with the stone. Now, where they got the rest of the stone to finish the building, I don't know. All I know is that the front came from the gas works, which had been the Dominion Penitentiary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now there's a few other things.
Do you want to talk about Gussie's?
Oh, yes, the social gathering.
Yes, that's right. Gussie's was a small restaurant underneath a small apartment building on the corner between Windsor Street and Roby Street on Quimple Road on the north side. And it was a gathering place for people from QEH, St. Mary's, a few from St. Pat's. And of course, when you got in the college at St. Mary's, you were older than the others. And of course, as a guy, it was great because all the girls were interested in these big college Joes who were smoking pipes and trying to be as glamorous as they could be. And the interesting thing was the owner and operator of the restaurant was a William Russell, whose son was also William Russell, and or Bill, also called Gussie, and Mrs. Russell, of course, and they ran the Willow Tree Inn. And you know, that was probably the official name. And Mr. Russell always prided himself in having many barrels of maraschino cherries downstairs, in spite of the fact that it was the war was on. He hoarded this before the war. And Bill was nicknamed Mickey Rooney, and you'll see in some of the pictures that he did look a lot like Mickey Rooney did when Mickey was younger. And Bill was a pretty bright guy. This is young Bill. And he was the jotter in 1950 at our graduation time. And Bill decided to go off and become a Jesuit. So Mrs. Russell, and this is quite interesting, Mrs. Russell was president of the president of the Women's Auxiliary of St. Mary's, and she was not a Catholic. She was a very good friend of the Jesuits. So anyway, Mrs. Russell later became a Catholic when Bill became a Jesuit priest. So all those people are dead. Bill died quite young. He came out of the Jesuits later on, got married, and he's dead now about 3 or 4 years, and Mrs. Russell is gone. And Mr. Russell had died some time before. So that's where the parking garage is. But it was kind of an interesting place to go. And then Dalhousie had their place. And I forget what the name of it is. We never went there very often because you were going off your neighborhood territory. Theirs was on Spring Garden Road. Just at the foot of Colbert, where Colbert and Spring Garden join.
About your fellow students, what type of family background were they from generally?
That's interesting. When I left St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, a lot of my classmates came along. Jeff Flynn, my cousin, and I had some other cousins, Flynn boys, in other grades. And we were all pretty good academically. But as you got older and you got more distracted by girls, your grades went down. But they were all basically middle-class people. There was some that had come, as I had told you, from Herring Cove. This was kind of a phenomenon that I've noticed personally, that the pilots must have made a fair amount of money before, and particularly during the war, piloting the ships out of the harbor. There was the Hayes, Bishop Hayes, of course, is part of that family group. There was the Ladders and many, many names that ring bells at Herring Cove. So they moved their children in the city. A lot of them have moved back because of the nice environment of Herring Cove and the improvement of transportation. And they bought homes in West End, Halifax. So you saw them at St. Thomas Aquinas, and they followed in turn over to St. Mary's. Now, prior to the war, mainly during the war, people in Halifax were quite concerned about bombing and bombardment. So there was also the fear that, you had to stay in university or else you were in the military if you were of age. So a lot of the guys went to university, and as long as they kept the grades and they were a member of the COTC, the Canadian Officer Training Corps. But on graduation, if they didn't do postgraduate work, they immediately went into the military. Now, one chap went into the military, Eddie Arab, and there's a little park over off of Cobra, Shabakto Road called, I think it's called Eddie Arab Park, and you immediately became a lieutenant in the military in the U.S., and he was leading his platoon of, I think the platoon was around 20 men in France, and he just stepped up and he was shot and killed. So if you didn't keep your grades up, you were gone in the military. So a lot of fellows didn't want to go in the military. They wanted to get the grades, and if they went in the military, they wanted to go in on their own terms as officers. So there was a COTC room in the university where they had a full-time sergeant major. And of course, he administered, he had all the guns and all the armaments and things, and the COTC students had their own uniforms. And there was a little white thing on their wedge hat that indicated they were COTC, as opposed to regular military. We in the high school, I think we had our choice if we wanted to, could join the cadets. So if you joined the cadets, they issued you with a uniform except for your boots. Oh, this was great. You were a cadet. So it was fun. And then the COTC went to camp in the summer. We didn't get that privilege. I think I had mentioned to you that the university students in engineering went to camp for a survey camp, a survey and geology camp to Truro, in your third year, which was a lot of fun. You were there with the Tech students, and you were there for approximately 3 weeks of wonderful food and doing your engineering thing. Mm-hmm. And you got to see some girls, but they weren't too interested in you in Turl. Something else I'm forgetting. I'm trying to think what it was. My particular hobby or sport was hunting, as you can see in this room. Mm-hmm. And my family, of course, spent a lot of time in Mount Uniac. My father had been an immigrant from Lebanon, and I guess he brought with him a desire to hunt. My mother was a local Irish-French-Acadian girl by the name of Flynn from North End, Halifax, who were fiercely loyal to the Irish side of the family. So, of course, when St. Patrick's Day came, everyone wore green, even if they were black, you know?
See, about your fellow students as well.
Their backgrounds, yes. You asked me that.
Yeah.
They were all sort of basically middle class. Their parents probably didn't have a high school education. My father went to grade 8. He was an immigrant, very bright man, and quite successful in business and so on, but grade 8 would have been as far as he would have gone. Mm-hmm. My mother, I assume, probably would have been around grade 8 at St. Pat's as well, mm-hmm. at St. Pat's School down on Brunswick Street. And of course, the explosion took place in 1917, and her brothers and sisters were injured. Her brothers were injured, and her father was injured. And I suppose this had an impact on how far you went in school. And there was 9 kids in the family. Mm-hmm. And her father sold PEI potatoes. It was called Black and Flynn, and it was a wharf. So in later years, I understand there was a little bootlegging down there. But prior to his death in around 1923, they had sold or traded Nova Scotia timber for PEI potatoes. Mm-hmm. But the other interesting thing about the sea was that my mother's grandfather was a captain of a barkentine that sailed out of Pictou, and their names were Babin, which was French-Acadian, and he married a Walsh from Waterford, Ireland, and their daughters and so on intermarried into families in Antigonish. And they would trade up and down the seacoast of North America, and one of the sons got bitten by a dog in Cuba, one of the islands of Cuba, and he was brought home in around 1890 back to Pictou in a keg of rum, the same as Napoleon was brought back from Waterloo. And he was buried up there. I don't think anyone's ever found the rum. And part of that family then ended up in New York and Philadelphia. So all the Irish and French Acadians are spread along the north coast of, northeast coast of North America. You'll probably find relatives right down the coast if you investigate it. Mm.
So you had boarders at school at the time?
Yes, there were boarders there. And you were aware at the time there was some from Newfoundland, very few from the city, you know. I suppose a few that the parents want them to go in the university or the high school and board. And no doubt they have strong feelings for the university because they actually spent time there. Now, I assume they slept in one room. I think that was the way it was set up. Mm. Now, the priests had an area where they stayed. They had their rooms wherever they were, and that was out of bounds to the students. And there was a name for that, and it just slips my mind. There's a name for that sort of thing where regular people aren't supposed to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are about the areas that I wanted to cover. Unless you can think of anything else you'd like to add?
There was something else, and it's, oh yes, when the war ended, VE Day. That was 1945, and of course we were students then. So, of course, Barrington Street was wrecked, and there was rum, and there was all kinds of things all over the place, and debauchery. But prior to that, there was also times when ships would sink by torpedo right off Herring Cove. So then there would be contraband brought into the city. There would be military ration kits, and there was tractors and all sorts of things. Some property sold through people who were salvaging them. And others, of course, it was contraband. Gasoline was very scarce in those days, of course, and you had gasoline rationing coupons. Probably only had 5 or 10 gallons for an ordinary car for the year. You know, if you had a truck, you got more. So the students were into this at home. They, the ones that would have been from Herring Cove, would have had all that contraband. Now there was the people who came from Dartmouth. They could blame. They could say that they were late because the ferry was late, or they missed the ferry. And quite a few of those people came from down at Cold Harbor area. And so there was the Dartmouth students, there was the Halifax students, and there was the boarders. That was sort of the various divisions. I spoke to a chap by the name of Tom Barry the other day, and he was extremely interested. I didn't realize that people who had gone to St. Mary's at the time that I was there are fiercely loyal to the memories, and they all have little antidotes that they have. The one story that I told the other day, I must repeat, was the time in the Roorum, which was the building outside that we talked about that was rebuilt by my father's company, Butler Brothers, around about 1945. And it was a rink, and it relied solely upon natural air to freeze it, and it kept the sun off it, but the ice didn't stay in very well. And there wasn't really very many places to sit and watch the game. You just sort of stood around it. And during the breaks in the morning, the recess, the students would go out, and this probably would have been high school or maybe freshman. But David Janigan, who's now quite well known as a doctor in the city, what is the name of a person who looks at the dead people?
Coroner.
He was the coroner, very well known for it. David was a dark chap. I don't know what his racial origin was, but he was a real character, very bright. And David was on this great hawser, rope, hanging from the beams or the trusses. And he had a little fellow named Fred Cable was sitting on his lap with Janigan holding himself together at the bottom on a knot. And I was swinging them. And Janigan was saying, "Higher! Higher!" And snap, the rope broke. And Janigan went down with Fred on top of him, and his leg was broken. So we never saw Janigan again. This may have been, as I say, grade 11 or freshman. And he lost a year over it, but yet,